All right. Well, again, good afternoon, everyone. And again, just a reminder that today after services is a sermon chat. And one of the wonderful things about that activity that we do is that everyone collectively can come together to discuss their perspectives and bring insights into areas that we maybe individually might have overlooked or maybe not thought of in the same way. And for today's sermon chat, I'm hoping, it says there's only a handful of us here, each one of us is going to have to bring our A game, because I'm really interested to hear your perspectives on the topic today. To set the stage for our sermon today, I want to turn back to Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11. This is one of the several scriptures that we're going to be turning to over the course of this sermon that you probably just went through during the Feast of Tabernacles, because they're these wonderful millennial messages, scriptures that point to a period of time where God is directly interacting with human beings on the earth. And although God did have a relationship with Adam and Eve, and of course he had relationships with individual human beings throughout time, there will be nothing like this before or after where God himself will be directly involved, right in the middle, so to speak, in guiding and directing humankind throughout all aspects of their physical lives. Now, it's going to be a remarkable change from how it's ever been up to this point. In what ways, you might ask? Well, let's investigate here in Isaiah chapter 11, and we'll pick it up right at the beginning in verse 1, Isaiah 11, verse 1. It says, "There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. His delight is in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears." Now, we're going to keep going in this chapter a little bit further, but I don't want it to slip by without us noticing that God is already describing a change here. Now, it's easy to go on in the rest of this chapter and focus about the changing characteristics of animals, which is obviously very important, and that's what this section of Scripture is famous for. But notice that even judgment itself will be different. Verse 3 again, "And he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears," but how? "But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with a rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, who shall stand as a banner to his people, for the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious." Now, this is not an exhaustive list of changes that one can expect in the millennium. The Bible, as we no doubt have come to realize very early in our conversion, it rarely gives us everything that we want to know, but rather instead gives us enough where we can get the point. In this chapter, we see that the way of judgment and mercy and how they're metered out will be changed. We also see the natural state of animals being changed. We see characteristics of human behavior changing. We see judgment, equity, even knowledge of the Lord and his way of life generally being spread around. So one other example, and these are fun to read because they're so hopeful and they're so wonderful. This one's in Isaiah chapter 2. You can turn back there. It's probably a memory verse for a lot of us. Isaiah chapter 2, we'll read verses 2 through 4. Again, focus on the changes that are being described here. Isaiah 2, starting in verse 2, it says, "Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths.' For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." So these are big changes all the way around. Kind of hard to fathom changes too, because it's so different than what we experience today. And it's certainly very different than what mankind has experienced throughout its history. And we know that the full fulfillment of these visions and these scriptures can only be accomplished with the complete wholesale changes brought on by God. We understand that leading up to the millennial period, mankind will have put themselves in a very precarious position through their wars and through pestilence and the like, that Jesus Christ will be required to return to the earth in order to prevent mankind from wiping themselves out. So at that point, the world will be at the lowest point it can get, and then God will implement his changes that will bring about the peak of the physical world, where things are running like they should be. There will be, again, nothing like it before, and there will be nothing quite like it in the future, at least not for physical human beings. So, I want to ask you a question today. And then afterwards, we're going to go through a couple of examples here for the balance of the message. But I really hope that it just primes the pump for the chat that's going to follow afterwards. And the question is this: can we, as human beings, ever get close to these millennial scriptures by working on incremental changes over time? Or does it require God's radical wholesale changes? Now, let me rephrase that in a slightly different way. Let's say, just as a thought experiment, that we were all suddenly transported into positions of authority where we could pass laws, we could make committees, we could implement plans and strategies at the national level or even the international level. And if that was the case, could we incrementally get closer to God's way of life on a physical level? Could we move that needle even a little bit closer to the examples we read about in Isaiah chapter 11 or Isaiah chapter 2? Now again, we know that the full fulfillment of these verses is only possible with God's direct involvement on a spiritual level and a change of human hearts of stone into hearts of flesh, and for God's Holy Spirit to be involved as the very character of man and woman are changed. So we get that. But God did lay out plans for physical Israel, right? He did give them instructions on how to run a physical civil society, and certainly his principles are the same now as they were then and as they will be in the millennium. Is it possible to move mankind incrementally closer to those verses in Isaiah and others by working to implement those principles and putting them into action now? Well, further along in Isaiah, this time in Isaiah chapter 32, verses 16 through 18, I'll just read these three verses. It's Isaiah 32, verses 16 through 18. It says, "Then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The work of righteousness will be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. my people will dwell in peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Those are admirable goals. Are they possible? Now, some would argue, myself included, that mankind has made quite a bit of progress in a lot of areas. Let's take a few examples. What about global poverty, for example? That is a big worldwide problem. Extreme poverty is designated as someone that is making less than $1.90 a day. So they take what $1.90 would buy today, and then they use that purchasing power through time to try to gauge how many people were in extreme poverty. In 1820, nearly 90% of people lived in extreme poverty. In 2015, only 10% do. That's a pretty big change. What about literacy? In the year 1800, 88% of the people were illiterate. In 2016, now it's only 14%. Also in the year 1800, 43% of children died in the first 5 years of their lives. 43%. Now it's 4. That is a remarkable change. And even in the shorter term, we continue to make iterative progress on a lot of things. When I moved out to Virginia to start my career in the year 2000, since that time, the rise of people that have access to clean water globally has gone up 10%. 10% is also the same amount of increase that people now have access to power that never had it before. Air pollution deaths have fallen for 27 straight years in a row. And although it's dipped just recently in the United States, global life expectancy has increased for 57 years in a row. So it is possible to make iterative changes for the better in the quality of life for human beings. That is demonstratively true. The famous Chinese philosopher Confucius from a few hundred years before the time of Christ wrote this. He said, quote, "A man who moves a mountain begins by carrying away small stones." So what about it? Is it possible for mankind to pick up one stone at a time and slowly and collectively improve to the point where the physical world pictured in Isaiah is within reach? Or does the whole mountain have to be moved all at once? Is it possible if we can get Curtis elected to the presidency, if we have Lucas running the UN, if we have Dr. Britt at the World Bank, could we steer the ship just a little closer to the ideal destination? Or are God's principles so foreign that they would just be rejected outright? Well, today I want to focus on two areas of life that will specifically be changed, that must be changed, that they are very different currently than what God intended and what will be different in the millennium. And we could talk about a whole host of systems. We could talk about healthcare or the government or education or entertainment, all of those systems and many, many more. You could even save those for the Bible chat if you wanted to. But the two that I wanted to cover today is the judicial and the financial system. The judicial and the financial system. Both of these have pretty clear examples in the Bible of what God intended and then also what God will restore in the millennium. But just to make things a little bit more interesting, we can't cheat here. And what I mean by cheating is that we can't point to parts that are obviously broken and things that everyone thinks that are broken, that everyone knows aren't working well, and hold those up as straw men to tear down. So I'll give you an example of what I mean here. The prison system. We all know that the prison system is completely busted. There are over 2 million prisoners in the United States as of last year. And if we were in a contest, we would easily take the gold medal in terms of the quantity of prisoners and as the percentage of the population. The second highest incarceration rate is Turkey, and we are crushing them by almost double. Americans rarely do things halfway, and that is no exception. But we all agree that that system is broken. We just, as a nation, can't figure out how to fix it. So instead of pointing to these obviously broken systems, instead I want to frame this whole conversation differently by saying that we're the ones in charge here. In our hypothetical world, we're calling the shots. Is it possible to incrementally improve those two systems, not just by fixing the busted parts, but by changing the very way that they work and the very way that they function and model them after a system that God has designed? Well, let's just dive in, shall we? Well, the first aspect or system that I want to investigate is the judicial system. And one of the interesting concepts that I want to point out right away, and not just about the judicial system, but in both of the areas that we'll cover today, is that just how impressive it is to me on how progressive the Bible is. There are many attacks from people that claim that the Bible is too old-fashioned, that the principles don't hold up to modern times, or it was for like an ancient group of people in the middle of nowhere, and it can't be applied to us today. That we, as a group of people, are much more learned today. We have data models, and we have PhDs, and all sorts of things to make our ways smarter and better. But time and time again, it is demonstrated in real-world situations that the Bible was not only very progressive when it was written, but in a lot of cases, it's actually much more radical and progressive than the systems we have in place today. Let me give you an example within the context of the judicial system. Back in Moses' day and for generations before and thousands of years afterwards, nations were ruled by kings, of course. They created the laws, they enforced the laws, they decided what was considered right and what was considered wrong. If we think back and we remember the stories of Daniel in the lion's den, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Esther and King Azarias, all of those stories involved a king making a rash decision, forming an entirely new law, and then immediately putting it into execution. Now, if you were just a regular citizen during that time, and maybe you got a great and wise king, and your life was great. But if you didn't, then you would be in a lot of trouble, because they, as the kings, did what they thought was right at that time, and they directly put it into action. They were the originators of what was right and what was wrong and the laws that governed it. It was an entirely new way of thinking that the Israelites weren't to do this. The Israelites weren't to decide for themselves what was right or what was wrong. God gave them the laws and the principles, and they were just to enforce them and mediate between one another and implement those principles. And as a result, God created a system where, since the law didn't originate from man, man couldn't just change it to suit their purpose. Even Ahab and Jezebel, widely regarded as some of the worst and corrupt rulers in the history of Israel, even those two couldn't completely subvert this system. I want to turn back to an example in 1 Kings chapter 21. 1 Kings chapter 21. This is the story of Ahab wanting the vineyard, and it belonged to Naboth. I think we remember the story. Ahab wanted it. It was next to the palace walls, and Naboth refused. This was Naboth's ancestral land, so he was in the right here to refuse. And when he does so, Ahab, he goes back and he pouts and he sulks around, because even as the king, he couldn't just unilaterally do whatever he wanted. He was still accountable to the law. But his wife, Jezebel, comes to his evil rescue. But notice how she solves the problem. Let's pick it up in 1 Kings 21. We'll start in verse 8. 1 Kings 21, starting in verse 8. It says, "And she," that's talking about Jezebel here, "wrote letters in Ahab's name, sealed them with his seal, and sent letters to the elders and the nobles who were dwelling in the city with Naboth. She wrote in the letter saying, 'Proclaim a fast and seat Naboth with high honor among the people. And seat two men, scoundrels before him, to bear witness against him, saying, "You have blasphemed God and the king. Then take him out and stone him, that he may die.'" Well, why didn't she just order Naboth's death? Why did she have to use these liars to subvert the judicial system through false accusations? It's because even though the sad state that Israel was in at this time, there was still this remnant of a judicial system that held people accountable, and that everyone, including the king and queen, were subject to it. Now, to be clear, by this time in Israel, it was just a very thin strand connecting it to God's initial purpose, but it wasn't yet broken yet. The system that God put in place was designed to hold all people accountable. Nathan had the authority to walk into King David's chambers and confront one of the most powerful rulers in the history of the nation about his wrongdoing with Bathsheba. In many countries today, if someone confronted a dictator or a ruler, that person would be thrown into jail or worse. Even in our own country, people in positions of power can maneuver themselves outside of authority and accountability of the judicial system. But that's not the only change. There's two big ones found in Deuteronomy chapter 19. Let's head back there. Deuteronomy chapter 19. This principle is also in Leviticus, but I think Deuteronomy brings out some better context. Deuteronomy 19. We'll start in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 19. It says, "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established." Now, we just read about Jezebel doing this exact thing, using these liars for this reason. Verse 16, "If a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priest and the judge who serve in those days." Again, no one is above accountability. Verse 18, "And the judges shall make careful inquiry. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who has testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother. So you shall put away the evil from among you." This is a big one. Anyone can bring charges against someone else as long as they have multiple witnesses, but they better be telling the truth, because it's not just that the case would be dismissed, but rather it's turned on its head and applied back to you. But there's more. Verse 20, "And those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter they shall not again commit such evil among you." Verse 21, "Your eye shall not pity. Life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot." This eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth concept, like many others in the Bible, can be misrepresented by Bible critics. They would point to this scripture and they would say, "This is a great example that the Bible shows no mercy, that it's all about exacting revenge to the fullest extent possible." There's another famous quote that is kind of vaguely attributed to Gandhi. They say that he said, "An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind." But actually, it's a much more profound principle and another great example of where the Bible is actually much more progressive than the system we have in place today. It's not just that the punishment should exact every ounce from the offender, but rather that the punishment can't exceed the crime. Rather than a commentary on the cruelty of the Bible, it's really an example of mercy within the judicial system. The offender must repay and make it right, but they can't be buried in a punishment, especially for a minor crime for which they cannot recover. It's more about restitution and making one whole so that the community can heal and move forward. Just think of how much would change within our own judicial system if we made just those simple changes. In just a few short verses, God lays out a judicial system that is based on some core components: equal enforcement, where everyone is accountable, involvement of witnesses, thorough investigation and strict punishment of false accusations, punishments that fit the crime, and restitution-based versus punitive-based judgment. And all of these are physical constraints. It doesn't take into account any areas of the heart, like mercy and righteous judgment, etc. These are all physical constructs. So back to our original question, would it be possible to make iterative changes in those areas to get closer to that judicial system that God intended? Or does God need to come in, just wipe the slate clean, and start from anew? Zechariah chapter 8, verses 16 and 17 really puts it in plain language. At Zechariah chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. Zechariah 16 and 17. It makes it seem so simple. Makes you think, surely everyone agrees with these ideas. Surely together we can move the ball forward. Zechariah 8, verse 16 says, "These are the things you shall do. Speak each man the truth to his neighbor. Give judgment in your gates for truth, justice, and peace. Let none of you think evil in your heart against your neighbor, and do not love a false oath. For all these things that I hate, says the Lord." The judicial system that God intends is one where everyone is treated equally, where no one is above it, one that values truthful witnesses and vigorously penalizes false witnesses, and where punishments fit the crime in order for restitution to take place and for people to return back to their lives. Can we get there iteratively? Well, I hope you're writing your thoughts down for Bible chat. We'll come back to that. But next, let's move on to the second aspect that I wanted to cover. The second aspect is financial. Second aspect is financial. And this is one of my favorite aspects to think about because as a small business owner, I pay a truckload in taxes. And the idea of just paying a tenth of my increase sounds like a dream to me. But obviously, the financial system that God designed is not just about the tithe, but it's a holistic approach to resources and wealth management. The Bible does have a lot to say about this topic. One author suggested that there were 2,300 verses in the Bible related to money or possessions. I'll be honest with you, I didn't go through and count them up myself, but there's no doubt that there is a bucket load throughout the Bible. And not only that, you can kind of cherry pick almost any position you want by selectively pulling out one of these 2,300 verses. Christ said that it was easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom. So you could cherry pick that one out and say, well, maybe God doesn't want anyone to be wealthy. Paul said in Romans, he says, owe no one anything. So you could cherry pick that one and say that I guess having any kind of debts is wrong. Peter pulled a coin out of a fish's mouth. So I guess we could say that we need to treat fish like a slot machine. Really, any position on wealth, you can find some scripture in the Bible to support it. From living a chaste life in poverty to being blessed with more riches than you can ever spend. But even so, God did outline some specific principles about the financial system that the nation of Israel was to adhere to. Now, I'm personally convinced that God wasn't always terribly concerned with the wealth of individuals, but he was concerned with the financial system within the nation of Israel. And he will also enforce similar changes to the financial system in the millennium. Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 25. Leviticus chapter 25. There are quite a few of these principles that God has put in place in this chapter. I want to highlight a few of them. Again, Leviticus chapter 25. And we'll start in verse 8. Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 8, it says, "You shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all of the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return again to his family." Now again, this is another example of the Bible being much more progressive than our modern day society. Can you imagine the cancellation of debts every 50 years? People being able to get out from underneath negative situations and get a fresh start. This single rule would require a rework behind every major financial system in the world. But let's keep going, dropping down to verse 13. Verse 13, same chapter, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his possession. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor, and according to the number of years of crops, he shall sell to you. According to the multitude of years, you shall increase its price, and according to the fewer number of years, you shall diminish its price. For he sells to you according to the number of years of the crops. Therefore, you shall not oppress one another. But you shall fear your Lord, for I am the Lord your God. Well, what would be the principle behind this? Was God so dead set that the family of the tribe of Zebulun always occupy some real estate in some narrow geographic region in Israel? Well, maybe, I guess. But rather, it seems to me that God was building in a safety valve that would allow the people to reset. I know I mentioned that our focus isn't to just regurgitate all the negative things in the world now, but just to use as an illustration, the most common cause of bankruptcies in the United States, 66% of them actually, is from medical debt, including those that have health insurance. And Sarah and I got some exposure to this and how quickly something like this can happen when we were going through Olivia's treatment. When she was first admitted, we got a visit from the social worker, and they sat us down, and they just started to go through all the impacts of what a high-cost treatment would entail. And I remember during this first meeting that the counselor said that most people, when they enter this situation, both of the parents are working full-time jobs. They have some savings, not a lot. They're just regular, everyday people. But once they enter into this scenario, one of the adults has to quit because they have to stay at the hospital full time. And so they're on reduced income. They quickly fall behind on rent or mortgage payments. And then they lose the house. And then the stress of all that financial causes the family to get a divorce. And just this single issue of being in the hospital like that, through no fault of their own, they didn't do anything wrong at all, can wreck two whole families. And sometimes it can take years and sometimes never to dig out from that situation. And again, not because the family did anything wrong, but just because there wasn't any way to reset and recover. Now, Sarah and I, we were incredibly blessed and we had just a huge amount of support and we escaped that situation. But unfortunately, it was not an uncommon one. We saw it play out with other families in the hospital with us. Now, I want to continue on in this same chapter. I want to drop down to verses 35, still in Leviticus 25. But as we get there in verses 23 through 28, it talks about allowing the redemption of things that were sold out of necessity. Again, this is just ways for people to reset, recover, bounce back. Verse 35, though, that's where I want to pick it up. Still in Leviticus 25, verse 35. It says, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner. That's interesting. That he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, for your brother may live with you. You shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. Again, this is a safety valve that is incorporated into the community to allow those that are poor or that have the need to be able to stay afloat. Now, there are other scriptures that we won't turn to that even add more to this principle. It's not just that you aren't supposed to suppress the poor, but you're to proactively enable them. And it's not just about sharing and helping, which are important, of course, but also for granting opportunity. For example, the famous story of Ruth, where she went out in the fields so that she could reap food for her and Naomi. So we remember this story. When she got there, they had nothing. And Boaz was doing what God had commanded by leaving areas in his field open where it was possible to go and harvest. He didn't go in and cut it down and hand it to her, but instead he had the policy in place where this principle was implemented. If you were willing and able, there was a spot for you to go. And when Boaz notices, he even takes a little bit further. He tells his workers to be just a tad bit more careless so that she had more opportunity to glean if she was interested. But I do want to notice a comment by Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, we're going to start in verse 7. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 7 says, "For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have the authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat." Now, this is a solid principle that is throughout the Bible. Paul just says it a little bit more directly. He says that you have to contribute. If you want to eat, you have to work. And this might be literal physical labor or not, but it definitely means supplying a meaningful contribution versus strictly receiving a handout for nothing. Now, meaningful contributions can be all sorts of different things. And it also means that how people think about work and the value of work can change over time. In the financial system that God outlined for the Israelites, it wasn't focused exclusively on gaining wealth or by squeezing out every last bit of productivity from each worker. Now, wealth could be used as a tool, there's no doubt about that, but with greater wealth came greater responsibility. It was more of a tool versus the goal of work. Our capitalistic system that we live in now would have to be upended almost completely, and it wouldn't fit into this model. And I've given a lot of thought to this over the years, because if I had to go back and start my career all over again, I probably would have picked something different. I always wanted to do robotics, and I almost went into that field when I graduated high school, because I've always been fascinated by robots. And robots have been around for decades, obviously, but it's just in the last handful of years where they've reached a point where they can kind of, quote, learn tasks and adapt to their environment. And we're all used to seeing these huge, like industrial robots at a car plant that just kind of do the same rote task over and over again. But that is old school now. Robot technology has gone light years past that. There was one cool example that I saw where it was inside of kind of a warehouse, a small warehouse, and a person was taking components off of a shelf, doing some light assembly, then packaging it up and sending it off. And there was a robot that was watching her perform these jobs. And when she wanted the robot to learn what she was doing, she reached over and touched a spot on the robot's arm. And then the robot would watch her assemble these tasks. And through machine learning and some AI intelligence, the robot then would know if it came across any of these components again in the future, it would know how to assemble them, package it up, and send it out on its way. It was really remarkable. And that really makes me think about in the future, perhaps in the not too distant future, where the nature of work will change. If a robot or a machine or some automation can replace most jobs, how will that impact our society? Now, I enjoy listening to economic podcasts that talk about this very thing, because you can already see how disruptive it can be for the whole nation when driverless automated cars started to be introduced. And that was just a relatively small change in a relatively small industry, but it had a huge rippling impact throughout the entire financial system. But in the financial system to come, we have something interesting taking place. I want to go back to Isaiah chapter 65. Isaiah chapter 65. And what we're going to read there, it can be applied in both a physical sense with physical human beings, but also in a longer term sense, even after we have become spiritual beings. Again, that's Isaiah chapter 65. Let's pick it up in verse 20. Isaiah 65, starting in verse 20. It says, "No more shall an infant from there live but a few days, nor an old man who has not fulfilled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree, so shall be the days of my people. And then get this. And my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth children for trouble, for they shall be descendants of the blessed of the Lord, and their offsprings with them. What a change it will be when people can focus on meaningful work that they long enjoy, something that challenges them, something that helps them learn and grow and not have to be tied down to a dead-end job just to make ends meet. The financial system that God intends is one where people can recover and bounce back from financial ruin, where money is a tool and not just the goal, and where options for truly meaningful work are available to those who seek it. Well, as I start to wind down here, I want to go back to one of my most favorite scriptures in the Bible. It's in Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17. We're going to start in verse 1. Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 1, says, "Now, when they had passed through these two cities, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Then Paul, as his custom was, went into them, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, 'This Jesus whom I preach to you is the Christ.'" Now, I find it very likely that Paul probably discussed a whole host of things with them, all from this foundation that Jesus Christ was and is the Messiah. And if that's the case, all of the fantastic things that this means when he returns. Three Sabbaths is ample time to go through some of the same scriptures we read today and tie them to Jesus Christ and the amazing promises to come. Verse 4, "And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of devout Greeks, and not a few of the leading women, joined Paul and Silas. But the Jews, who were not persuaded, becoming envious, took some of the evil men from the marketplace, and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar, and attacked the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people." Now notice this next verse, because I think this is what says it all. Verse 6, "But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, 'These who have turned the world upside down have come here too.'" Now, the way of life that God brings, his way of life, is so drastically different than what they were experiencing 2,000 years ago, and it's equally drastically different than what we experience now. And when Jesus Christ returns to the earth and the millennium starts, there will be complete, wholesale, widespread changes throughout all aspects of their lives. The world will quite literally be turned upside down. And even in an ideal world where man and women work together to put together the best plans that they can, spend generations making iterative changes and improvements, even then, it still pales in comparison with God's plan and his way of life as he changes the very hearts and the very minds of his spiritual family. No human plan could ever completely fulfill the picture that we read about in Isaiah, because ultimately, even if this world was running great, even if it was running wonderfully, we still need the kingdom. We still need the place that God has prepared for us and all that want to follow him. But does that mean we should sit back and wait? Or can we take the principles that God has outlined and move the ball forward inch by inch? Well, in conclusion, the British government founded a very peculiar office in 2010. It was called the Behavioral Insights Team, or BIT for short. But it very quickly acquired a more fitting name, and it was called informally the Nudge Unit. And this was unusual because this government office was tasked with using nudge theory to improve the lives of the United Kingdom citizens. And nudge theory is using positive reinforcements and kind of indirect suggestions and very small incremental steps in order to make very large changes over time. And this group, they had a string of very impressive results in getting things like people to pay their taxes on time. They changed the way they sent out fines for court fees. And just the way that they changed the wording and how they went about it, it ended up saving over 30 million pounds every year. Even simple things, like trying to encourage the citizens to add more attic insulation so that the nation as a whole had less heating and cooling energy requirements. Simple things like that, they were successful in nudging people to make very big changes over time. And this unit was so successful that it was copied in various forms to lots of other governments, including the United States. And even the military took this lesson and started their own nudge unit. In one example, they were struggling to get the military was struggling to get their service members to save money for retirement. Only 44% of service members saved any money for retirement, whereas for government civilians, it was double. So they took this nudge unit suggestions and they made these small tweaks about how they went about it and a lot of positive reinforcement. And in the end, their trial run, adoption rates went up 8%. And then they took it to the national level and used the same sort of nudging and small tweaks and changes, and enrollment doubled. All of these people are big believers that small incremental changes can lead to big positive changes over time. And sometimes it has been proven that when people work really hard on a problem, they can slowly, iteratively change the trajectory in a huge and positive way. Well, what about these huge changes that God will implement in the millennium? Is it possible to start even now and slowly get closer to the principles God has shared with us? Or again, are we just left waiting? When Jesus Christ came in the flesh, he didn't just point to a time in the future when God will fix everything and say, well, I'll see you in a few thousand years. He did take actions while a physical human being to improve the lives of those around him. And he gave the principles and examples for us to use within our own lives to live as lights upon a hill. But can it be more than just individual changes? Can we move whole systems closer to God's ideal? The principles of God's way of life are timeless. God gave the Israelites concrete physical steps to take in designing and implementing their judicial and their financial systems. In the millennium, he is likewise going to change those systems to more accurately reflect his thought process and his way of life. So again, what about now? Is change possible? Well, I guess we all get to talk about it in about 15 minutes as we start our Bible chat. So with that, Sarah, let's do another song.